Thanks very much for coming in. Welcome. I was wondering, you've just written the book, The Greatest Show on Earth, which is a series of arguments, of evidence for in support of evolution. What's the one that you would choose if you had 15 seconds? What's the clincher?
I suppose the clincher would be the comparative molecular genetics, looking at the distribution of genes throughout the animal kingdom and plant kingdom, because the information is so detailed and so voluminous. There's such an enormous amount of detailed textual information. You can literally compare animals and plants with each other, letter by letter, word by word, paragraph by paragraph, and actually count the number of similarities, the number of differences. And it all falls perfectly into a hierarchical tree, a family tree.
And this is something that you can read in the gene, in genetic sequences of all the organisms you're talking about?
Every single organism that's ever been looked at has the same genetic code, and therefore you can read, just as you could read different versions of a book.
And so the only possible explanation for that is that they've all come from one particular ancestor?
Well, it's by far the most reasonable explanation. And also the closeness of cousinship. I mean, rats and mice have almost the same words, letters, and chimps and humans have almost the same, but rats and humans have somewhat different, and humans and octopuses have rather more differences. But in every case, you can find sufficient similarities between the genes to say, this gene in the human corresponds to that gene in the octopus or the kangaroo or the rat or whatever it is. And you just count the number of differences, and the number of differences fall beautifully into a hierarchical family tree. And what's more, you get the same thing with every gene you look at.
And when was that kind of evidence first available?
It couldn't even begin to be available until after Watson and Crick 1953, the discovery of the double helix. It took a while after that, but ever since then, ever since Watson and Crick 1953, genetics has become a branch of information technology. It really is just like computer tapes, just like written text. So you really can literally count the number of differences and similarities, knowing that they come from the same source. The theory is not that difficult. I mean, it's not in the same league as quantum theory or relativity for difficulty of understanding. There are elements of difficulty. You can't really get it unless you appreciate the vastness of time that there's been for it to happen. Geological time is much greater, much longer than any human brain has ever been asked to contemplate. So we're used to decades and years and even centuries. Millennia kind of start to get a bit difficult to understand. But a million years, we just can't begin to grasp. As for 100 million years, which is what the sort of timescale you've got to get your head around if you really want to appreciate the history of life, then it's just way beyond our comprehension. It's not in principle difficult like quantum theory, but it's just harder. And I think that may be part of the problem.
I was wondering if there's also something about the fact that evolution explains all of the things we see around us, the great variety of plants and animals we see around us, which is kind of an obvious thing to people. They've seen the plants and the animals.
Well, they know they exist, but surely the fact that they're so complicated and so elegant cries out for an explanation.
Yes, and then evolution explains these things by adding further intermediates or animals which we no longer see from, that we only see in the fossil record.
Yes.
And so in a sense it's taking something that people are comfortable with, are familiar with, and adding other bits on top
That, the logic of that doesn't work, does it? Because they have no right to be comfortable with it just because they could see them. I mean, it's one thing to see something, it's quite another thing to understand it. And you can contemplate a Boeing 747 and you can see it, you know it exists, but you're not satisfied until you're told how it came into being. In this case, engineers designed it and built it and so on. Well, in the case of a living thing, like a porcupine, you can see it, you know it's there, but you must have an explanation for why it exists. Now, many people are brought up with a spurious explanation just God did it. You might just about be satisfied with that if you didn't think very hard. But it's not good enough just to say, well, I can see it, therefore it doesn't need an explanation.
Is one of the problems that the way in which evolution changes organisms is so, as you say, it takes such a long time and it is such a complicated process.
That it's very difficult, slow, yes.
And it's very difficult to actually nail down exactly the reasons for which transformations
I think
occur
that's from. Right, yes. I mean, I think there are plenty of people who call themselves creationists who are quite happy with what they call microevolution. They can kind of cope with the idea of a peppered moth population changing from light coloured to dark coloured. What they can't grasp is that it's changes of that kind, which if you splice them together end to end over a very large number of millions of years, you get really big changes, like the change from a fish to an amphibian.
At some point, the evidence for the exact transformation you're telling isn't there, so you use a word like presumably.
Exactly.
Is that part of the problem?
Yes, I see what you mean. I mean, that could be a part of the problem because, as I said, we know the general kind of form that any of these stories will take, and that's good hard science. But for any particular case, it may be that we have to resort to a plausibility argument. It could have been like this, it could have been like that. We don't know exactly how it was. Maybe we will one day when we get more fossils. But for the moment, it just has to be a plausibility story.
And this is perhaps one of the difficulties for evolutionary evidence confronted with those who are predisposed not to believe it, is that when you say presumably, then those people you are trying to convince are exactly those people who will not go with you on that plausibility story.
Well, I suppose, but it doesn't show much imagination, does it? Because, I mean, in any historical subject, there are gaps. You don't know exactly what happened. You know certain landmark things that happened because you've got strong written evidence for it. And then you say, well, what happened in between these two is it might have been this, it might have been that. This is the kind of thing that would have happened. What would not be plausible would be if the story you needed to make up just couldn't happen, if there was something really radically unsound about it. But there are all sorts of detailed ways in which it might have happened, that, say, fish came out of the water onto land. It might have been because all the lakes dried up and so they were forced to migrate or something. I mean, there are all sorts of different details, and there are different alternatives for what happened in human evolution. Were we driven out of the forest into the savannah and forced to change our way of life? I mean, those are just details for things that might have happened and might not have happened. What we can be sure of is that however it happened, the general principles of Darwinian natural selection were at work, and the details are nice to think about, are nice to speculate about, and in some cases we actually have evidence. I think it might be a lost cause trying to people who really, really are totally convinced that the Bible is literally true, which, by the way, wouldn't include any reputable vicar or bishop or cardinal or anybody like that. But I think that somebody who actually, I mean, there are people who've actually said, I don't care what the evidence shows, the Bible is true and that's that. And you can't really argue with people like that. I'm not sure I'd bother. Mm. It's just that there are enormous numbers of people who don't really think that, but who haven't really been exposed to the evidence.
There's a moment in the book where you describe an experiment on fruit flies, which you always wanted to do, but which you never quite had the time to carry out. Is it a regret to you that you spent so much of the last 20 years championing science and not actually doing it?
Yes, I suppose that's right. I mean, I think of experiments that I would have liked to have done, and that would have been nice. But on the other hand, there are lots and lots of scientists doing that and doing it very well, and I can read about it and listen to them and write about it. So I think there is a role for somebody like me who writes about science and thinks about science and puts forward theories and ideas about science rather than doing experiments.
But you don't miss the nitty-gritty of the lab work?
I do a bit, yes, but you can't do everything.
Do you wish that some of your colleagues spent a little more of their time speaking up publicly for science?
Well, I do really, yes. I mean, I think, and many of them do, of course, I think there is a responsibility of scientists to do that. For one thing, the money ultimately comes from the taxpayer, and so you need to put forward the case for science, and you need to show in a positive way. I mean, you need to show how exciting it is and how wonderful it is, the things that are being found out. And I think there used to be an attitude among scientists that you sort of rather look down on those who talk to the general public. I think that's changed, and so it should.
It's changed because more of your colleagues are doing so, or because there are other pressures on scientists to do so?
I don't know which of those it is. I mean, there's a thing called the Carl Sagan effect, whereby Carl Sagan, the great American astronomer and populariser of astronomy, was denied fellowship of the National Academy of Sciences, which is the American equivalent of the Royal Society, pretty clearly because his colleagues just resented his public face. And, I mean, he certainly deserved to be elected a member of the National Academy for his astronomy, let alone for his magnificent work in making astronomy attractive to the public, who ultimately are responsible for paying the bills for the astronomy that his research colleagues were doing. He was denied fellowship of the National Academy. I was elected a fellow of the Royal Society rather later. And so I think I have nothing to complain about in that on that score. But I think Carl Sagan probably did, not that he was the complaining type.
I'm wondering if there's an irony that you feel that one of science's most visible voices isn't really doing so much science anymore.
I don't have a problem with that at all. But I mean, I am doing science. I'm not just popularizing. My books actually do contain theoretical ideas which do change the way my colleagues think. And I think that's probably especially true of The Selfish Gene, but it's probably true of my other books as well. Many, many of my colleagues have said that it's not just popularizing, it does actually change the way they think, change the way they do their research.
In The Selfish Gene, you talk about the neck cube, the way that the transformatory way of looking at the same evidence is almost as valuable as new evidence. Is that something that you've been aspiring
well,
to
yes,
throughout your career?
The Necker cube is a two-dimensional drawing of a cube on paper, say, and when you look at it, you see it as a three-dimensional cube, but there are two different ways of looking at the two-dimensional pattern of ink on paper, and it flips from one to the other. The cube seems to be looking that way, and then suddenly it will flip and look that way. What that is that the brain has two different alternative models, hypotheses really, of what might be going on in the real world, and the ink on paper fits either of them, and so it flips from one to the other. The analogy for me was two different ways of looking at a particular set of scientific facts, scientific evidence, and seeing a new way of looking at it, which might or might not actually be a new hypothesis that you can test. But the new way of looking at it makes you think of new hypotheses that you can test in ways that you wouldn't have thought of if you hadn't had that flip in the mind. And I think that's partly what I've been trying to do. The Selfish Gene, the idea that an animal is a survival machine for the genes that ride inside it. That's nothing new about that. I mean, in a way, that follows from neo-Darwinism of the 1930s. But to put it in quite that language does make you think differently. When you go out into the wilds and with your gumboots on and start doing research on real animals, if you see it, if you see the animal you're looking at as a machine for propagating its genes, then you see it in a different way, and you actually have different sorts of ways of doing research than if you just see it as an animal that's trying to survive, say.
Reflective thinking about theories and evidence which are already there, which you've been conducting as part of your career, is an equally valid part of science as getting out there with your gumboots on.
Well, I'm not sure about equally valid. I think it's a different kind of contribution. I think it's an important contribution. I suppose the distinction I'm making is a distinction between that, what you just described, and mere popularising. I don't like to use the word mere, but mere popularising in the sense of taking what every scientist knows or in the field knows and bringing it to the attention of the public, which I do as well. But also this other thing of changing the way the scientists themselves think, which from time to time, I think many of my books have actually done.
I see. But you still feel very much as a scientist yourself, rather than as reporting on scientists over there. You still feel very much part of their camp.
Yes, I do. Yes.
As a prominent voice for science, is this with environmental catastrophe arriving on human society, certainly? Is this the right fight to be picking?
It's a good point. I mean, there are plenty of other fights that might be a better fight to be picking. You can't do everything, and you know, maybe one of these days I'll get around to writing a book about global warming. I haven't read up the subject yet. It's a big subject. It needs a lot of attention. Maybe I'll do it, but so far I haven't got around to it.
So it's not so much that you've chosen this fight, as this fight has come to you, and you've.
I think I mean, I didn't sort of have a sort of life game plan. This is what I'm going to do. I mean, I tend to drift into something and then drift into something else, and so it wasn't a very deliberate choice.
I'm wondering how you'd choose to be remembered, as what your epitaph would be.
Well, I think I would like to be remembered as a scientist who cared passionately about the truth and who thought that scientific truth is so beautiful and so elegant that it's worth helping other people to experience the same joy as I've experienced from it.
Mm. So it's very much as a scientist who is engaged with the ideas that underpin scientific achievement.
Yes.
Rather than... Well, thank you very much indeed.